Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I'm Jessica Hinken. And this week on the podcast, we are going to do something a little bit different. This is actually a format that we had done in 2016 for the then Baltimore mayoral race. And we did it again. And it was called The Blueprint for Baltimore Stoop Mayoral Show. It was in tandem with Open Society Institute, which has been a great partner of Stoop's along the way.
And for this event, we asked Baltimore's 2020 mayoral candidates to share a true personal tale about an epic fail. So a pivotal loss, disappointment, or setback in their personal life and how they came back from it. And the idea behind this is that we need a mayor with resilience, creativity, and the ability to collaborate to make this city all that it can be.
And we need someone that is authentic, that we can trust.
That's right. And so when we hear how the candidates dealt with a personal disappointment and defeat in their own lives, I think we'll get some insight into how they'll help Baltimore revive and thrive. So we're going to share all the stories that were shared at the show and enjoy them, and hopefully they'll give you some insight into who these candidates are and who will be the best person to lead the city.
We have to. We must find some kind of time, some kind of place, some type of peace, some kind of peace.
Everybody, welcome to the Stoop Virtual Mayoral Show.
I am Jessica Hinken.
And I am Laura Wexler, and we are so excited to be out of the house.
Are we ever? We are not in our bedrooms right now. We are in the safety of the Creative Alliance, where we got started in the first place. So what is it that we are doing today, Laura?
So we are bringing you the stories of Baltimore's mayoral candidates, but we're doing it a little different than we usually do things at the Stoop. Instead of folks coming up on stage and sharing their true personal tale on the theme of overcoming adversity, we have recorded them in their homes.
So we used Zoom, we used QuickTime, we used voice memos, we had each of the candidates tell their stories from their own homes, in the safety of their own homes, and we worked with a tirelessly amazing editor, Melissa Rogers, to put this all together for you. So the quality is going to look a little different, the bandwidth is going to be a little different for each story, and we just ask that you bear with us, because, right, this is the new normal. And we could not have done this without OSI's support, so thank you so much, Evan and Bobby. And without further ado, take it away, Laura.
So before we get started with our first storyteller, we're going to need everyone in the audience to just really quiet down. Thanks. Okay, so our first storyteller is TJ Smith. He's a native Baltimorean who's worked at the top of a couple governments in the area, so you might recognize his name. He has two master's degrees. He's the son of a teacher, and he's a former law enforcement officer, which figures into the story that you are going to hear next. Now, warning, if you have any squeamishness that has to do with things on the body breaking down or getting severely injured, you may want to prepare yourself for this story.
So about 10 years or so ago, I was up for a pretty nice-sized promotion with the Anne Arundel County Police Department, where I had been working for about 10 years at the time. Promotions are a big deal in police departments. You have to study, and my studying went on for around 4 to 6 months. You have to buy your own books for promotion. You form study groups, and you put a lot of energy and a lot of effort into trying to rank high enough in order to get promoted, especially the first go around, because you're ranked and you can not rank high enough and not get promoted in that round of promotions, which the list lasts for about 2 years. So that really can delay your career. So I was back and forth whether or not I wanted to do it. And then I finally decided that, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do it. We formed study groups and we worked our hardest to do as well as we could. You get down into the details of knowing exactly how many vacancies there are, exactly how many people might get promoted at a specific time. So you know all this and you use that as fuel for your studying and trying to do better and better on the exam. So once the exam time comes, I take my tests, I pass my tests, and I do well enough at the test that I'm ranked where I'm going to be among the first group of people to get promoted. That's great. I'm happy. I'm excited. And I'm ready to go on and move on and get promoted. But you have to wait a period of time. So during the time that I'm waiting for the phone call to say, congratulations, you've been promoted, I'm out doing regular things. So I'm playing in a South Baltimore flag football team. And I decide at the end of a game, and the game was basically over, that I wanted to play Ed Reed. And the ball is thrown up in the air, and I said, I'm going to intercept this ball. And I go up and I intercept the ball, and the person on the other team decides to defend it. He comes down on me after I intercept the ball. Now, he was wearing metal cleats, which were a no-no. And I would have never known that he was wearing metal cleats until he stepped on my Achilles tendon and severed it in half. No one really was paying attention to me because the game was over while I lie on the ground in agony and in pain. So as we leave, I go straight to St. Agnes Hospital. I lay on the table there. The doctor comes in and says, we're going to have to do surgery. At that moment in time, I knew that the promotion was going to be out the window because you have to be healthy and working in order to get promoted. So they tell me they have to do surgery, and they did the surgery. For the first 72, 84 hours of this, the pain, of course, and then the thought process. I'm a normally healthy individual. I had never taken any sick leave. So it was something that I was accustomed to going to work. And now I'm out of work for the first time. And then just days later, I get the phone call from the chief. We'll promote you next time. Well, I have to wait until I get healthy to get promoted. And I don't know that the next time is going to come because, again, it's about how many opportunities are available at the time. And you could eventually not get promoted on the list if the vacancies never present themselves. After about that first 72 to 96 hours or so, the pain starts wearing off. And I said, I'm not going to sit back in agony about this situation. I decided to pick up some books and learn something I didn't know as much about. I read two books in particular, one called Discover Your Genius and another called Super Rich by Russell Simmons. And this book wasn't about getting wealthy. It was about finding the wealth within you. And I was able to write several screenplays, and I really trained myself in my craft of trying to become a better writer at that moment. After 3 months passed, I was getting in a groove of being off work and being at home and doing other things. And I was doing them so well, when it was time to go back to work, I said, oh man, I'm not ready to go back to work. But fortunately, I went back to work with a new mindset, a clear head, and a new set of skills that I didn't even know I had. And I eventually got promoted, and I went right into an acting role and got officially promoted months down the line. So it ended up being one of those situations where at the moment that it happened, it was agony. It was a sense of defeat. It was a sense of, I can't believe it. I even held out hope that when the chief called me, even though I knew the answer to the question, I thought he was going to say, we're going to go ahead and promote you. We know you're coming back. No, I didn't get that luxury. I went in for my interview on crutches, and he told me that they weren't going to be able to promote me until I was healthy again. Fortunately, I got healthy again, and I was able to get promoted a couple more times afterwards. And again, I was able to take from that moment a set of skills and an opportunity to learn something different. And I'm forever grateful for a painful, agonizing moment that really brought me through and taught me something, and certainly teaches me something about this current moment that we're in.
Catalina Bird is telling her story from her stoop in Reservoir Hill. She is a mother, a strategist, and a community activist who's running for mayor.
You know, when people ask me about adversity in Baltimore, being from Baltimore, you meet all kinds of it. But I think the one that has most shaped my adult life and found its way into my work is that of becoming a widow at the age of 26. There was absolutely nothing that prepared me in August of 2007 to wake up and my whole life be turned upside down. A single mom out of nowhere with a four-year-old son and trying to figure out the words to explain that daddy was never coming home again. In the early years, in that particular year, I was actually considering and had formed an exploratory committee to run for city council. Kiefer Mitchell at the time had just vacated what was then the 11th District Council seat to make his own bid for mayor. In the wake of my grief, I opted to disband the exploratory committee and instead thought it was only appropriate to pour myself into my family and give myself time to heal and grieve appropriately. I'd always had the intention to run for mayor when I turned 30 years old. For me, that meant running for office in 2011. But I always thought my husband would be by my side. So for a couple of years, maybe 08 and 09, I didn't think that I would still do it. But then there was something in me, his voice in the back of my head, that would have been disappointed in me if I had given up on my dreams and everything that I'd worked for just out of fear because he wasn't here. He didn't love me or marry me or let me have the honor of giving him his first and only son because I was someone who stayed away from things because I was scared. So in 2011, my son was the very first person to sign the petition for my bid for mayor as an independent candidate in Baltimore City. It was an amazing experience that brought me a lot of great memories. I've made some really great friends and colleagues in the process, and I wouldn't trade it again for the world. I didn't think I'd ever run again after that, though. We didn't get enough signatures to get on the ballot because we found out it was kind of difficult to explain to people that signing the petition to get on the ballot isn't the same as voting for someone. We have a lot of civics education we need to do in Baltimore still. But nonetheless, that particular year, the incumbent, former Mayor Stephanie Rawlins Blake, won, and people went back to business as usual. They still believed only a Democrat could run Baltimore City, since that's all they'd seen since 1967. In 2015, 21217, the area code of which I'm a born and raised native and still live, we had an uprising after the death of Freddie Gray. Former Mayor Rawlins Blake opted to not run for mayor again, and I got a lot of questions about whether or not I would come back in the 2016 election. I did not. Once again, I had to choose family and what was best for my children over that was my goal and my aspirations for Baltimore. In that time since, I'd had a daughter, and she was only 3, and campaigns are full-time jobs. But this year, so much has changed. So much after the Gun Trace Task Force, the removal of former Mayor Pugh, sitting on the Community Oversight Task Force, being a part of the consent decree implementation process, the time felt right. I had the relationships inside of BPD and across party lines. And so now, with the same ingenuity that I had in 2011 and inspired and still motivated by hearing my husband's voice, I'm back to bring the change to Baltimore with the vision that I've always had for it since I was a little girl.
Brandon Scott is a lifelong Baltimorean. He is grew up in Park Heights. He went to Mervo and then St. Mary's College of Maryland. He's also a huge O's fan and was the youngest council member to be elected to the City Council of Baltimore City at age 27.
When I think about adversity for me, I think back to my fifth grade year at Dr. King Elementary School in Park Heights, where I played on the basketball team with some of my closest friends, and that decision was about to be made, where we were going to go to middle school. And I think that this is what shaped me and shaped my service, because growing up in Park Heights, I saw my first shooting before I was 10 years old. We would often, find bullets, drugs, all of those kind of things on our way to school, and sometimes even passing bodies. And when I look back now to that basketball team that I played on at Dr. King, and I think about how two of us really are successful in life, and the other members of the starting five are either dead or severely addicted to drugs, I think about like how we overcame that adversity. And my one friend and I have one thing in common that the rest of them don't. Before recording this, I drove past one of them on a corner in Park Heights because I know what that was. That was opportunity. My mom and his mom were able to find out that we could go to Roland Park for middle school. And they just fell into that opportunity for us. They just applied out of nowhere. We were able to both get in, and that changed our life. And that's how it shouldn't be in Baltimore. We should not be the exception to the rule. We should not be successful because we went from Park Heights to Roland Park for middle school, which changed our lives, while our friends went to Green Spring Middle School. That's the inequity in Baltimore that I've been trying to fight my whole life. And thinking about that adversity, thinking about having to go from Park Heights to Roland Park to have to deal with some of the racism in the neighborhood, right? When we were getting out of school during half days, or trying to get food from the local market, or interacting with neighborhoods and neighbors, just like the young people here in Baltimore today at Roland Park that I stood with. Thinking about how we still had the challenges of living in our neighborhood, but that one change, that one chance, that one opportunity created this pathway for me to be successful. That led to me going to Maryville High School, which led me to St. Mary's College of Maryland, which allowed me to understand my purpose in life. And every young person in Baltimore, everybody in Baltimore should have to and be able to realize their full promise, not just based on the opportunity for them to go to one school or the next, or live in one neighborhood or another, because we all lived through that. We all lived through that violence. We all lived through drugs. We all lived through zero tolerance. All of these things that were very hard, where we had to put our head down, where we had to duck bullets, where we had to ride the bus for hours going to and fro school. I know what it feels like to be on the bottom and to live in the forgotten Baltimore. That's what drives me every day to try to make Baltimore a better place, because I know the statistics say that I shouldn't be where I am. And my life's dedication is going to be that I want to change that for the generations coming behind me. That's what I'm about. That's the story for me. Overcoming adversity through opportunity, an opportunity that I want to provide for the next generation in Baltimore.
Valerie Cunningham, I spent 20 years working in the federal government, and since she's left those jobs, she is now a licensed real estate agent. So if you are looking into cash in on the low interest rates, you can see her. She is a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. She lives in downtown Baltimore, and she's sharing a story about how her career in the federal government began on a less than auspicious note.
My story of adversity is about my former spouse and I. He's former spouse, so my ex-husband and I met in college, and we married. He was commissioned as an Air Force officer. He was a missile launch officer, and our first base was in Knobnostrum, Missouri. So I found myself marrying my college sweetheart, and then I guess thrown into or propelled into this life of a military wife. I gave up my career goals. I actually have a bachelor's degree in broadcast journalism. So I've worked in radio and television. We followed him around to various bases. We started our family, and we got to Lompoc, California, where the job opportunities were very limited. They were opportunities for working in a federal prison or the military. Came to a point where my ex-husband and I decided that we would divorce, and I didn't want to go back home to Alabama, where we had this beautiful antebellum home, not antebellum home, but antebellum wedding at an antebellum home. And it just felt like a failure. I graduated from college, started a family, I went from hobnobbing at the officers' club and, in the officers' wives' club to now got a family, no job, and no husband. I ended up getting a job with the federal prison system. And again, my father was prior military and law enforcement, so he discouraged me from working in law enforcement, and I felt like a failure. That from the Officers' Wives Club to now at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy on the firing range with a shotgun. I came to learn, though, after working in the federal prison system, and it didn't take very long, that actually was what I was meant to do. I really have a passion for people. I'm fair, I'm firm, and just committed to people. I believe in folks. I'm very empathetic, and just because you start out in a place doesn't mean that that's where you're going to end up. So the adversity that I overcame was, taking the risk of of staying in California, where I didn't know anybody but my ex-husband, my child. I had no family there, and working in a prison system where I advanced into positions of increasing authority, and just really came to hone my skills with people and learning people and loving people and motivating. And so the failure ended up being my success story.
We're really excited to introduce our first musical guest, Dizzy Spells. And they include artist Sean Jones, who is a trumpeter, musical director, and Brene Ali, who's a choreographer, tap dancer, and vocalist.
Thank you all for joining us. It is an honor to share this work called Dizzy Spells. I'm Brene Ali, and this is Sean Jones. And we have been working on this concept of using the music of Dizzy Gillespie as a pathway into the future. So I'm very much into Afrofuturism, but also, you know, allowing this dizziness of what's happening in our world to kind of find a center and find the center or the eye of the storm. And so one of the songs that we're going to get into is called Kush, written by Dizzy Gillespie, who was a world leader in, you know, a jazz ambassador for peace. And so we hope you can ride along with us. Another ancestor that inspired this particular work, and we kind of playing around the idea of identity and chaos and what's going on and who we are. Also, shout out to Dr. Joy DeGroy for post-traumatic slave syndrome. Just understanding what's happening with our people, what's happening with our people. So James Baldwin said, one of the dangers of being a Black American is to be schizophrenic. It's to be schizophrenic. It's to be schizophrenic. It's to be schizophrenic. And I mean schizophrenic in the most literal sense. He also said that to be a Black America, to be a Black American and to be relatively conscious is to be in a rage almost all of the time. He also said to be a Black American and to be relatively conscious, 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 to be relatively conscious. It's to be in a rage almost all of the time. It's to be in a rage almost all of the time.
Thank you.
Before we get on to our next story, we want to thank Open Society Institute Baltimore, which is our partner on the Stoop Mayoral Show. They put together a great project called Blueprint for Baltimore, and along with a bunch of other community partners, they went around surveying Baltimore citizens for several months this fall to find out what people really want in Baltimore's next leader. You can find out about the results from that survey by Googling Blueprint for Baltimore, and it will help you kind of think about what do we need in a leader, what do I want in a leader, and help you choose when you mail in your ballot by June 2nd.
Mary Miller has called Baltimore home for 34 years. She has a career in urban planning and investing in cities. She worked under the Obama administration as the first woman to serve as the Undersecretary for Domestic Finance at the U.S. Treasury Department.
The hardest thing I've known in my life was the sudden loss of my mother. She was 65 and I was 39 when she unexpectedly died of a stroke. We lived 300 miles apart and were planning a trip together the following week. I'd saved up so many things to talk to her about, and suddenly that was lost too. So how to describe her to you? She was simply a force of nature. Tiny, under 5 feet tall, with a serious spine curvature. She never let anything slow her down. I remember her sitting on the Sears Roebuck catalog to see over the steering wheel of our family car. She grew up in Staten Island, New York City. Her parents came from Ireland. She was the first in her family to go to college, and she became a writer. She was constantly churning out short stories, poems, plays, even songs. She especially liked reading and writing mysteries. She was lively and warm, completely selfless. There was always another seat at her dinner table for someone who was lonely or just hungry, no matter how far she had to stretch that meal. I remember the kitchen drawer where she kept coupons for the grocery store, usually for desserts like brownies and cake mixes. All of this while raising 6 children, 3 boys and 3 girls. I was the second oldest. She loved us all unconditionally, but she had high expectations. And she had no patience for whining. One of her favorite expressions was, "Pull up your socks and get to work." Later, when I was juggling raising my family and a job, she always told me to stop worrying about all the things I had to do and just start doing them. It was good advice. Her loss was devastating to my family. She was in the prime of her life with grandchildren coming and so many plans. We all felt like the bottom had fallen out of our lives, but somehow we had to go forward. It's been 25 years. And I still feel her presence guiding me every day. It's the power of her life in mine. When I decided to run for mayor in Baltimore, I thought about all the ways she'd always told me to do my best, to use all the gifts that I had, and to never worry about the things that you can't do. She taught me how to get things done. With her loss, I learned to never take anyone for granted. I treasure my now 91-year-old father every day, and I don't wait to tell people the things that I want them to know. I stepped into her shoes for my younger siblings. I was there when my youngest sister had her first child, and when my youngest brother was looking for a job and needed a place to live. I convene all of my nieces and nephews every few years for a vacation together, and we talk about that lost vacation 25 years ago. I always try to model my mother's best qualities, putting others first, convening friends and family, the lost and the lonely, treating everyone with respect, and never forgetting to enjoy life, like making sure there's a dessert after dinner every night. After my mother passed away, a number of her close friends asked if they could be buried near her. Today, when I walk through that cemetery, I see her surrounded by a ring of friends. I like that.
Eric Powery is originally from New York, but he's now a Baltimore native who works in real estate. His story is about actually selling magazine subscriptions. So you know how sometimes you might get a knock on a door from someone who is selling you exactly that? Well, Eric can give you a window into the world of what it's like to be one of those salesmen.
A moment of great adversity for me was when I was having a difficult time in school at Norfolk State University. In Norfolk, I was living with my mom in Virginia Beach. I was commuting every day about 25 minutes. And, I started to just look for another opportunity, just looking. And so eventually I found a job opportunity that said you could travel the country and you could be a salesperson. It was very generic. So I went down there, filled out the paperwork as an independent contractor. They said, you know, you got to take a bus from Norfolk to San Francisco. You know, they paid for it. I was like, fine. I don't care. You know, I was young. And so went out, 4-day trip, you know, couldn't even shower, but was on the bus for 4 days. And then I got there and they picked me up in a Mercedes-Benz from the Greyhound station. I was all excited. I called my mom on the payphone. I said, Ma, I made it. I said, I'm going to do real good here. I said, this looks like a great company. And then finally Monday rolled around. It was time to work and the rubber met the road. And what happened was I got no, and more no. And for 4 hours, because it was always broken up into increments. And so I was crying. I was literally crying and disappointed because I'm like, how am I going to call my mom that I just told her I'm going to do good here and now I'm failing? And my boss came around and said, Eric, you can do this, man. He said, you're well-spoken. He said, you got good personality. He said, you can do this. And I went out there and I got 3 sales in a row. I didn't know what I was even doing or saying. And it was like, it was just a miracle that I got 3 sales in a row, and that built my confidence, and that was able to springboard me into being one of the top salespeople. And it made me know that, I mean, you get so much rejection in this in that industry that nothing affected me, and I did not, you know, I was able to always overcome adversity, and no didn't affect me as much because I became hardened to saying no, because again, you have over a 90% rejection rate easy in that industry. So that was a way that was helped me to toughen my skin and stiffen up my spine and become a stronger person and be able to move forward. And that's why I'm able to run for mayor.
So this next story is from Thiru Vignaraja, who grew up in the Baltimore area. His parents are Sri Lankan immigrants. He graduated from Woodlawn High School and went to Yale and then Harvard. He clerked for a Supreme Court prosecutor, became deputy attorney general, and is now a lawyer in private practice. The story he's sharing is about a time when something didn't go so well and how he reacted to it.
People often say to me that I seem equally comfortable in a black Baptist church as I am in an all-white corporate boardroom. They mean it as a compliment. The truth is, I'm equally uncomfortable. I'm always the one South Asian Hindu with a long, funny name. I always had to find a way to build bridges when none were obvious. My senior year of high school, I was captain of the soccer team, busy leading Woodlawn High to a 1-42 record. No, I don't mean 42-1, I mean 1-42, which I think is equally impressive. One particular game, we were playing another terrible team, and some kid from Dundalk said to me, after I took the ball from him, "Go back to India, Gandhi." I winced. It wasn't the first time I'd heard some dopey racial insult flung at me, but I was just starting to find my voice, my confidence, my footing on the field, among friends, in high school, in life. But there it was. Go back to India, Gandhi. I knew I was supposed to turn the other cheek. That's what good leaders do. Part of me wanted to go score on them, but we frankly weren't that good. Part of me wanted to point out that I was born in Sri Lanka and grew up in Baltimore, neither of which is India, and that Gandhi was a great peacemaker who wouldn't appreciate me going over and kicking his ass. I moved to Wordham to show how not Gandhi I could be. When Chris Sheridan, who had heard the comment, came racing out of the blue and decked him for me. I smiled. Chris got a red card, was thrown out of the game, and suspended for the rest of the season. I didn't think that was right, but I think we both felt pretty good about it. There was, let's be honest, nothing I could have said or done on that field that day to make myself feel like I belonged. But Chris could. Chris did. And I've never forgotten it. I've forever been grateful. I've forever been looking, frankly, for a chance to throw a punch for someone else so that they know that they too belong.
Zuleika Bazemore is originally from Washington, D.C., but she moved to Baltimore in 2013. She has 36 years of business and leadership experience. She's a graduate of Duke Ellington Performing Arts School and MedTech College. She's married as well to two-time USBA lightweight champion and IBC champion Kenneth, quote-unquote, the technician, Bazemore. She's raised three children. And that's all I have.
You don't
want
to mess with her. That's what I would say.
In 1991, which was 22 years ago or better, my son, Anthony, was struck by a car. His second year at University of Merlin Smith Business School in College Park. And what's amazing about this story is I was coming home from work. At the time, I worked on Capitol Hill for the Republican National Committee. And I was driving up New Hampshire Avenue and started running into traffic as I was about to make my turn on Sago Creek in Montgomery County where we lived. The traffic for that exit was actually backed up. And wow and behold, my son was laying on the ground, not breathing, and had just been struck by a car. He was dead when the police came on the scene. One of the police, fortunately, was a blessing and knew CPR. And EMS was on their way to a dinner break and pulled over and used a defibrillator. As I followed my son in the ambulance to Washington Hospital Center, if you can only imagine that I did not really have time to be in shock because my thoughts were to just get to the hospital and continue to be focused on following my son. Well, my son stayed in a coma for 3 days. And I've got to tell you, I was there the whole 3 days. My son came out of the coma and I was sitting right there standing over him. And he didn't recognize me as his mother. He was diagnosed with traumatic brain injury, one of the 200th person in the world diagnosed with TBI. What was some of the challenges? They were great. Because as I said in the beginning, in August the 29th of this year, it'll be 22 years. Well, the director of neurology told me, "Miss Moore, get over it. He's never going back to college. He's on a fourth grade level. He has severe brain damage." And I looked at that director of neurology and said, "Excuse me, but you won't have the last word. God, him, which was my son, and myself will have the last say." So when I took my son home, it was on all three of the local news channels. So when I called the director of HR at the RNC the next morning, she said, "Zuleika, I already know what you're going through. Go ahead. We're giving you 18 months paid family leave." We began to work. I went through a lot. I went from losing my condominium in Montgomery County. I went to watching my son see ghosts to jumping out second story windows to becoming lost. I mean, where he would run away from the hospitals, you know, when he had to go because they had to find the right medication to put him on because he was exhibiting schizophrenia symptoms after that trauma, but we found the right doctors, the right medication after through years. And when you tell me never, and when you tell my son never, it's never going to be never. Because guess what? Through all of that, it just made us more determined. It made him stronger. It made him a stronger young man, even though he went through a lot. For those people that I see, even in Baltimore City, that are on drugs because they've gone through some trauma or they're going through something. My son went through that. He started smoking marijuana. Did I deal with that? Did I permit it? No, because my son knew his mother did not agree with altering and making his situation worse. So we worked with that. Okay, I wouldn't tolerate that in my house, and therefore he would run away from home and get lost. But through it all, guess what? At the end of the day, my son now has defied all science, and he has now been accepted back at University of Maryland. I want to introduce my now 40-year-old son, Anthony Johnson, who we consider and call the Miracle Man.
So our next musical guest is Caleb Stein. And if any of you are longtime Stoop supporters, you might remember that Caleb Stein and the Brakemen were the Stoop House band for many, many years. Woo-hoo! And we have spent so many fun nights in this very room here at the beautiful Creative Alliance, listening to them play their music and sing their songs. And so we're so, so delighted to have Caleb here. Now we ask that all you ladies in the audience, please refrain from throwing any kind of lingerie up on stage when Caleb comes out to play. We really just want to keep it very calm and respectful.
Especially you, ma'am.
Thank you, Jessica and Laura, for that nice introduction. My name's Caleb. I am, as a lot of people, I'm a migrant here to Baltimore City, which I think is one of the most beautiful things about this place. It is truly the greatest American city because it is a city that is always in flux, and I've found it to be a great place to live for the last 20 years. The main reason is the people, and it's a great place to write stories, great place to watch the world go round. Here's a song I wrote about a year ago, and it's about overcoming adversity. It's about somebody who does that every single day. Cue the siren. Well, sunlight hits the rooftops and the coffee's kicking in. He can almost hear a train. He could almost crack a grin. The Econo line is running fine. And there's a parking spot out front. He grabs the clipboard, knocks on the door to learn what the customers want. Washers and dryers, telephone wires, bending steel with lineman's pliers, putting out fires, plugging up tires, whatever the day requires. Sometimes the part is new, sometimes you gotta make do. It might take nails and it might take glue, but you can solve any problem if you think you can. That's the life and times of a handyman. A tired woman opens the door, her kitchen sink is broke. Her kids run round the table and she offers him a smoke. He waves it off, unclogs the J-trap, whistling at the day. Yeah, and when he's done, he says maybe next time when she goes to pay. Washers and dryers, telephone wires, bending steel with lineman's pliers, putting out fires, plugging up tires, whatever the day requires. Sometimes the part is new, sometimes you gotta make do. It might take nails, man, it might take glue. But you can solve any problem if you think you can. That's the life and times of your handyman. drives on over to his friend's print shop just to oil some rusty gears. And then it's over to Seventh Baptist where he's hanging chandeliers. He grabs lunch at a diner. He gets a milkshake just because. The waitress smiles, looks at his hands, and asks him what he does. It's washers and dryers, telephone wires, bending steel with lineman's pliers, putting out fires, plugging up tires, whatever the day requires. Sometimes the part is new, sometimes you gotta make do. It might take nails, man, it might take glue, but you can solve any problem if you think you can. That's the life and times of a handyman. He's your handyman. Call him when you can.
Now, we know all you out there in the theater tonight love to party. Oh my God, you guys have been so crazy. But we also want to let you know that you can party at your mailbox.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
I don't know.
By going to baltimorevotes.org/party. That's P-A-R-T-Y, not P-A-R-T-E-E. Party. And you get yourself one of these free boxes.
What's
party
in the box?
At the mailbox. Now, what is in the box that Jessica Henkin is asking? You got your poster. Woo! Saying you love Baltimore and you're going to vote. You got your crab chips. I'm not throwing them on the ground because they'll shatter. You got your T-shirt designed by the folks at Micah.
Yeah,
you can wear it proudly. You got your burger cookies. I'm also not throwing them on the ground, even though I don't think they would shatter. They come real tough. You've got some balloons, because
yes,
everybody loves balloons. We also have one more thing, so you can make a little noise. Here's yours.
Okay, with a Clorox wipe, thank you.
Here's mine.
Just a little bit
one,
of poison.
One, two, three.
Vote.
If that does not get you out to vote, we don't know what will.
I think a lot of other things would, actually.
That doesn't
seem all that motivating.
Get your ballot. When it arrives, if it arrives, fill it out, send it in, or drop it off at one of the ballot boxes in the city by June 2nd. And if you want to have a party while you're doing it, because really, who doesn't? Go to baltimorevotes.org/party and sign up for a pre-party. Pre-party? You got a pre-party, but you also have a free party at the mailbox. Okay. So this next storyteller's name is Sean Gresh, and he's from Massachusetts. He moved to Baltimore a few years ago. He's a longtime corporate speechwriter and manager. He now teaches at a university, and he has a really interesting early career history in that he was in the Catholic Brotherhood. So he was teaching in his school. He had taken a vow of celibacy, and he actually ended up leaving that, getting married, having children, and better yet, writing a book about sex. So
yeah,
please listen to Sean's story, which actually doesn't have any sex in it, but is still a good story.
In the late 1980s, I lived in Andover, Massachusetts, in a beautiful home with my wife and three children. I was at the top of my career as a speechwriter for a major company and also as a manager for that company. In January of 1991, however, I got divorced. And that was the beginning of one of the worst years of my life. By April of that year, I had moved out of the house and we were forced to sell it at a very low price. And so we lost virtually half of our life savings. By early May, there was a rumor at the company where I worked that all of us would lose our jobs, all 300 of us. And so we were asked to go to a facility of the company about 30 miles away and there'd be an announcement, but they wouldn't tell it what it was. But we thought pretty much that we were going to lose our jobs. So what I did is I thought, this is just not fair, but at least if we're going to go there, let's go there in style, and let's go there where we can kind of stick together as a group. So I talked to a limousine company, and I said, I'll barter with you if you allow, if you take us in limousines to this big meeting where we think we may lose our jobs. We're pretty sure we may lose our jobs. So they agreed, and I did some PR work for them in exchange. What happened is we got there. It was a very somber trip there, and we found out that we indeed were let go. We had 3 months, however, to find new jobs, and our ride back was very sad, but everybody was very happy that we were released together and so forth. When I got back, I met with one of my fellow managers, and we put together a workshop for 6 weeks to prepare us to look for jobs, to be able to handle interviews, to find out what it would take to start a new company, to find out what the taxes are involved if we started a new company. So we're really prepped for jobs. And so fortunately, what happened is over the course of 3 tough months, where we were all worried about our futures, we all landed up with jobs. And now when we look back on that period, that very difficult period, we have smiles on our faces, especially when we think about the crazy idea that we all had and that we experienced by riding in 2 stretch limousines to and from a meeting that was going to change our lives.
Sheila Dixon has 3 decades experience in public service. She's a former educator, a current mom, and an avid bicycle enthusiast. If you look carefully at the cyclist next to you next time you are in your car at a stoplight, it might indeed be Sheila.
So one of the challenges, or one of the things that I would say in overcoming adversities, is when I had to leave office, the one thing that I learned from that experience is that I would always, in every aspect of my life, be transparent in whatever I do and be truthful and honest, because ultimately, when you hide anything from anybody, it still comes out to light. And despite what people might think or feel about me, not knowing the entire story, I gain a sense of strength. I gain a strength of confidence, as well as a strength of humility in whatever the next chapter of my life and what I've been doing for the last 10 years. And so when I talk to young people, when I talk with women groups and sharing my story, I let them know that you, no matter how bad it is or how bad you might think it is that just be truthful and honest to people, that your family, to your friends, to whomever, to your colleagues, and that the outcome of that only uplifts you to be stronger in who you are as a person. It uplifted me to be more committed to the causes that I know that I want to be engaged and involved in, because I know I make an impact in people's lives. And so when I run across somebody in the community who has a challenge, if it's a homeless person or a person that I run into in the supermarket that has had a challenge, and they feel comfortable in coming to me, I share them my story and I share with them the lessons that I learned. And for me, it has allowed me to know that I can make a difference and an impact in people's lives because of the lessons that I've learned from my prior chapters in my life. And I'm not going to allow anyone to define me by those past experiences, because of who I know I am and whose I know I am. And the fact that, you know, I have to give credit to my family, to God, to the angels that surrounded me over the years, for praying for me, for believing in me, and knowing that, you know, I am a good person and that I only want the best for others. And so I think out of that challenge, those are the lessons that I've really learned over the years.
Shannon Wright is a former state board member of the NAACP. She has crafted and written policy for the State Department, HUD, and the White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. Her story is about the importance of education.
When I was born, my mom was a single teen mom, and we lived in the projects with my grandparents. We learned pretty quickly together. We kind of grew up together. And when I went to school, she went to work. When I got home from school, my grandparents watched me, and she went to school. So we kind of learned that education is the one true sustainable key and way out of poverty. So it was important that to prioritize that and to understand education and its importance. Growing up, before I was 16, my mom had developed some health issues. And although she and my dad had gotten married, I was her primary caregiver because dad had to work. I went to school, but I didn't take that silver spoon street road through. I went to school. Things got rough at home. I needed to come home. Dad passed when I was still in my 20s. And that made me, once again, caregiver for my mom and my younger sister. When you become caregiver at that age, you learn to prioritize education, you learn to prioritize money, you learn the real value and importance of healthcare. So for me, I understood the sandwich generation of having to take care of the ones younger than me and the ones older than me and the different things that it took to really make that possible. I want to make sure as mayor that I do all that I can do to make sure families have the tools and the resources they need to be able to raise their families, to be able to succeed and achieve more than the generation before them. It's important for me as mayor to be able to take care of changing the issues with food deserts. It's important for me to be able to take care of education so that we know when kids are coming out of school that they're ready either for college or trade school or for a job that they will soon someday be able to support a family of their own. It's important to me to make sure that we have health care. And I don't mean just a clinic here and there. I mean health care so that we can close some of the gaps and disparities, some of the things that COVID-19 has really put a bright spotlight on for us here in the city. I want to be mayor because I want to make sure that I do my dead level best to help families, to build the city. This is our opportunity to make lemonade from lemons. And if we work together, each of us, our families, our communities, as one big family, we can come out of this stronger, faster, and better than when we went in.
So we've come to the end of the 2020 Stoop Virtual Mayoral Show, and our final story will be shared by Mayor Bernard Jack Young. He grew up in East Baltimore. He attended Baltimore City Public Schools, and he started working at Hopkins at an early age. Then he got into community activism and politics, and now, of course, he is the mayor of Baltimore. He lives in East Baltimore still with his wife, Darlene, and he's a parent and a grandparent. And the story he's going to share is about something that happened to him early in his working years when he was coming home from work one day.
I was 19-year-old working at Johns Hopkins Hospital, getting off from work. On my way home, and there was a car that was leaking, a parked car leaking gas in front of a barber shop. And I approached the firefighter because people told him, oh, Jack knows who that car belonged to, and I actually did. The firefighter wanted to tow the car, and I told him I could find the owner. By this time, a police officer, he comes up, and he talks to the firefighter. The firefighter said that I was interfering in his duties. So the police started cursing and telling me and everybody that was around, get the F off the corner. And I really didn't appreciate that because my mom and dad never cursed at me. So we had words, and he placed me under arrest and charged me with disorderly conduct, inciting a riot, standing within 500 feet of a bar, which was across the street, more than 500 feet, and carted me off to Eastern District Police Station, where I stayed there for approximately 18 hours in a cell. And when I was released, I went home. All of the neighbors said that they would come to the court to testify in my behalf because I wasn't belligerent, I wasn't nasty, and that the police provoked everything that went on that day. Fast forward, we go to court. I'm sitting in court, almost the entire neighborhood shows up and gave testimony on my behalf. And the judge threw it out. The judge said that it was baseless and that I wouldn't have to worry about anything. It would be expunged. I will never have a record. It's like I've never been arrested. And I took that for face value. And I always wanted to be a federal agent. I went and applied to be a federal police. And upon applying, I was waiting for all of the paperwork to come back. And they sent me a letter telling me I was disqualified because I falsified my application by not telling them that I had been arrested. I was a young guy, young kid, didn't know that I had to say that I was arrested because the judge told me it wasn't a record, it would never be on there, and that I could go on with my life as normal. That's why I started a community organization called the Broadway Development Corporation. I do apologize for that. And started doing community activism early on during my life. That's why right now I'm in public service, to make sure that we hold everybody accountable, the police and everybody else accountable for what they do. And it taught me a lesson. I felt powerless, like there was nothing that I could do about it. But I found out that I could do something about it. I could help others not to fall into that same trap that I fell into. And that's why I'm where I'm in today, advocating for people's rights and making sure that the service they deserve that they get.
We want to thank everybody, and there was a large group of people who helped us to get this together. This was a crazy ride. We want to thank Open Society Institute of Baltimore for being a great partner and helping to fund this show. We want to thank Baltimore Votes and Black Girls Votes. We want to thank Creative Alliance, who helped us get in here to to host in a theater.
Safely.
So we felt a little more stoop-like than we would have in our bedrooms or offices or in our bathrobes. We want to thank the Hatcher Group, who helped us put together the video. We want to thank who else?
We definitely want to thank you, the citizens of Baltimore, who are our audience and the voters, hopefully, by June 2nd.
Yes, definitely by June 2nd. Optimism. And we also want to just thank all the candidates for coming on this ride with us. It was quite an adventure recording everybody on Zoom and on voice memo and all these other technologies.
We learned a lot about QuickTime.
We learned a lot. And we want to just thank the candidates for being game, and also all the people on the candidate staff, their girlfriends, their relatives, their tech experts. Just they really, really were game to try this with us. Above all, we hope you enjoyed the stories. We hope to get back in front of a live audience soon.
God,
but in the meantime,
willing,
please vote by June 2nd. We'll see y'all later.
Living on the West Coast now. Since September, you've been hiding out. People started asking around. They said, what's this all about? Holding up a ragged vow. It made you nervous. It made you dream.